make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. Last year at Loxton, he lost his entire harvest because 2,4-D sprayed on another property drifted onto his grapes. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
It's a foreign chemical. It's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes. It's on our sultanas, and it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products.
What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further. So they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he is constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
Cos leather's growing nicely.
Bottom line is, they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There's no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking up from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
You've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field, at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVNA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals and the environment. It's yet to finish that review.
Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995 but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
It is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat.
Some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believed this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Remember that you can contact us through our email, or better yet, through Facebook and Twitter. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Reporting reveals the households of at least 28 U.S. senators own a combined minimum of $3.7 million and as much as $12.6 million in fossil fuel assets. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, One in Four U.S. Senators Still Hold Fossil Fuel Investments Even as World Burns. Stay tuned for more. A new report published recently reveals that the members of the U.S. Senate who would have to pass climate legislation are heavily invested in the fossil fuel industry. Sludge reports the households of at least 28 U.S. senators in both the Democratic and Republican caucuses hold a combined minimum of $3.7 million and as much as $12.6 million in fossil fuel investments. According to the report, of the 28 senators, at least 20 hold publicly traded stocks in companies like oil supermajor Chevron, pipeline giant Enterprise Products, or electric utility NextEra that belong to trade associations that are lobbying Congress against taking up a strong legislation to curb polluting emissions. Five U.S. senators are invested in energy funds built around oil and gas assets, and three own non-public stock in private fossil fuel companies. The investments held by the senators, their spouse, jointly, or a dependent, are disclosed to the Senate Office of Public Records in very broad ranges and often buried in hundreds of pages of scanned paper forms, making a more precise count of their total value impossible. At least half a dozen of the senators sit on environment or climate-related committees. The Household of State Energy and Natural Resources Committee Chair Joe Manchin, who has worked incessantly to destroy or dilute climate action in the Build Back Better Act and beyond, has received over $1 million in income from Ener Systems, a coal brokerage firm the senator founded in the 1980s. According to Sludge, Manchin has stripped the Democrats' budget reconciliation bill of major climate programs that would have transitioned coal-fired plants, like the one where the company now run by his son holds the prime fuel services contract, while the committee he chairs also added more than $11.3 billion in funding to the bipartisan infrastructure bill that could benefit his family company's niche, waste coal industry. Other Democratic senators whose households are heavily invested in fossil fuels include John Hickenlooper, holds up to $1 million in investments in Chevron and other polluters. Tom Carper owns as much as $274,000 in Chevron and Duke Energy shares. Gary Peters has up to $355,000 in NextEra, DTE Energy and Pacific Gas and Electric stock in his portfolio. And the wife of Angus King, a Maine independent who caucuses with Democrats, owns up to $50,000 worth of NextEra shares. Earlier this year, Common Dreams reported that six Democratic senators, including Manchin, Chris Coons, Maggie Hassan, Mark Kelly, Kristen Sinema, and John Tester, have received hundreds of thousands of dollars in combined campaign contributions from fossil fuel corporations, some of which have touted their purported support for climate action over the past decade. The investments are valued at a combined minimum of $3.7 million and a maximum of $12.6 million, and many of them have been held by the lawmakers for at least 3 years. Of the 28 senators, at least 20 hold publicly traded stocks in companies like oil supermajor Chevron, pipeline giant Enterprise Products, or electric utility NextEra that belong to trade associations that are lobbying Congress against taking up a strong legislation to curb polluting emissions. Five senators are invested in energy funds built around oil and gas assets, and three own non-public stock in private fossil fuel companies. The UK research group Influence Map, which analyzes lobbying and communications, this month found that ExxonMobil and Chevron are the top two most negatively influential global companies on Paris-aligned climate policy. Exxon has spent about $4.6 million on political and social issue ads on Facebook so far this year, promoting itself as part of the climate change solution, while its officials hold leadership positions in trade groups including API and U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Chevron's first ever climate lobbying report this year did not attempt to reckon with its trade association's lobbying against policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In total, senators' households have as much as $275,000 invested in ExxonMobil and as much as $370,000 invested in Chevron. Influence Maps analysis found that the most negatively influential lobby groups on emissions policy were API, AFPM, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the National Mining Association. API's millions spent on Facebook ads this year have recently opposed the Build Back Better Act as anti-industry legislation and have promoted natural gas as a solution. A 2019 report from over a dozen major environmental groups, including 350 and the Center for Biological Diversity, found that leaking methane from gas energy would push the world over the emissions bounds of the Paris Agreement. A conclusion affirmed in May by the International Energy Agency, which backed the winding down by 2040 of oil, gas, and coal power plants. Rick Scott, who won his Florida seat by 0.2% of general election vote in 2018, reported that his spouse holds an investment worth up to $500,000 in AG Energy Credit Appointments Fund, IVLP. Announced last year, the fund aimed to raise $1.5 billion to buy distressed debt of oil and gas companies and was affected by Angelo Gordon, a New York-based alternative investment firm that extends credit to companies in a North American oil and gas company. Several senators have disclosed selling off fossil fuel industry investments since their 2019 reports. Ron Wyden's spouse sold up to $50,000 in ExxonMobil on August 21st. Divesting in full from ExxonMobil as well as from shares in industrial conglomerate General Electric, whose stock is owned by at least five other senators. Diane Feinstein no longer reports an asset of $1,000 in gas company Antero Midstream that she and her investor spouse held in 2019. Republican John Hoven of North Dakota, the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Energy and a member of the Appropriations Subcommittee on Energy, no longer reports holding several oil assets that he did in 2019, including stock in Chevron, ExxonMobil, Marathon, and others that had been worth a combined $550,000 maximum. The average age of a senator at the start of the 117th Congress was 64.3 years, according to the Congressional Research Service. The median age of the 28 senators, including in this analysis, is 66 years, topped by Angus King at 77, Joe Manchin and Tom Carper at 74, and John Boozman at 70. Based on average U.S. life expectancy, most of the Senate fossil fuel investors will be dead before the plant reaches 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming above pre-industrial levels, as projected by the UN, to hit between 2030 and 2052, beyond which the most deadly impacts of climate change will begin being felt by those still alive.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists used explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism, but in reality it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halt its support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
Mali's government has called on Denmark to immediately withdraw troops deployed to the West African nation. Malian officials say the reason to ask Copenhagen for the troops' withdrawal is because officials in Bamako were not consulted and the deployment failed to follow protocol. Mali says all troops' deployments in the country need a prior accord with the government before deployments in the African nation. The decision comes amid tension between Mali and regional bodies, and the European Union that have sanctioned Mali after the transitional government failed to organize elections following two military coups.
Danish forces, without identifying themselves to Malian authorities, committed a huge breach in regard to their internal security and also diplomatic relations between the two countries.
About 90 personnel, including sergeants and special forces, and logistics support, were deployed in Mali. Their mandate was supposed to last until early 2023. They were part of Takuba Task Force, which is made up of European special forces. It's based on an initiative by France. Takuba's 900 soldiers are to help Mali's army acquire the combat skills necessary to become self-reliant.
It's a very outrageous situation. I think they are victims of European imperialist intervention. France, which is a former colonial power, intervened 9 years ago, yet the security situation inside the country is far worse than it was in 2013.
A French mission began in Mali in 2013 with the purported aim of countering militants linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France is a former colonizer of Africa. It has deployed thousands of soldiers to presumably prevent separatist forces from reaching Mali's capital, Bamako. In December, Paris withdrew from northern Mali and the city of Timbuktu 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or the French Parliament.
I do believe that France, you know, has committed grave errors in regard to its intervention in Mali.
The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. The withdrawal came amid growing demonstrations against France's military presence in Mali, which has been wrecked by two military coups in little over a year.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries, including Burkina Faso. At the same time, we have a new rash of military interventions and seizures of power in all of these Sahel countries.
France has been one of the world's colonizing countries that, after many years of slavery, still controls countries spread over more than 12 territories and treats their people as second-class citizens. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of its former colonies gained independence.
Brutality prevails, and that is the imperialist hegemony seeking to extend its influence and maintain its influence internationally.
Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of resources. France currently has 5,100 troops in the arid and volatile Sahel region. Under a new plan, they will be reduced to up to 3,000 troops. Analysts say it's premature to call it the end of France's military intervention in Africa, believing Paris is only readjusting its post-colonial plans.
The Yemeni army has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the two allies waging war on the country since 2015. It says vital and sensitive targets were accurately struck with drones and missiles.
They targeted the Safra airport. They also hit the Abu Dhabi airport with a big number of ballistic missiles, Zulfiqar. They targeted facilities in the area of Dubai with a big number of drones and unmanned planes of Samad 3. Also, several military posts in the heart of the Saudi area, in the area of Shobra, and other Saudi towns with bigger numbers of Samad 1 unmanned planes and also artillery fire. They hit very sensitive areas in Jazam and Asir, also with a big number of ballistic missiles.
Sari said the Yemeni army would continue its retaliatory attacks and respond to escalation with escalation. Saudi Arabia and the UAE have both confirmed the retaliatory strikes, but said they intercepted the ballistic missiles. The attack comes just a week after Yemeni forces struck several targets inside the Emirati soil using drones and ballistic missiles.
This war, this conflict has been doomed from the start, from the Saudi and UAE perspective, from the perspective of the coalition, from the perspective of the invaders. There is no chance for them to win. That's why there are several countries that are that are officially part of this coalition or allies of this coalition who have in reality barely contributed to it because they know there is no point to it.
The strikes are part of the reprisal attacks over the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and plunged the country into the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Following Yemen's latest attack on the UAE, the U.S. Embassy and its consular mission in the Emirates advised Americans there to, quote, maintain a high level of security awareness. The statement urges U.S. citizens to take appropriate steps to bolster their personal security. The American Embassy issued a similar alert last week when the UAE was targeted by Yemeni missiles and drones. The Yemeni army is now warning international firms and investors to leave the UAE as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. The sheikhdom is now feeling the economic consequences of the attacks. On Monday, the Dubai stock index fell by 2%, while Abu Dhabi stocks closed lower.
This has been very damaging for the economy of the UAE, which is based completely on trade, on commerce, on being a transit hub for both material and non-material trading and products that go around here. That's the only real thing that the country floats on. Without this commercial backing, the country has no future, and they think they know that very well.
Last week, the impoverished nation was hit by another round of brutal strikes by the Saudi war machine that targeted a prison claiming dozens of more innocent lives. The Yemenis have shown that the continuous onslaught on their nation won't weaken their resolve to defend their country.
Germany's stance in the escalating tensions between Russia and Ukraine is under increased scrutiny. Although other NATO allies, including the US, have also agreed to export weapons directly to Ukraine, the German government has so far declined to do so. The Wall Street Journal reported on Saturday that Berlin has refused to issue permits for weapons exports from Estonia to Ukraine.
The Germans do have a history of de-escalating and of not trying in any case to be in the forefront if there is any conflict. In the case of Ukraine, the official wording is that the Germans bear a responsibility for the happenings, the adventures of the last war.
German government officials have said they oppose sending arms to Ukraine as they fear that such deliveries could push tensions higher and make negotiations more difficult.
That's while Germany remains one of the world's top arms producers and exporters, with sales increasing 21% from 2016 to 2020. Kiev is furious over Germany's decision and is accusing Berlin of encouraging Russia to invade Ukraine, while the Kremlin denies the allegations. The US, Britain, and several Baltic states have agreed to send Kiev weapons, including anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, some 90 tons of US lethal aid arrived in Ukraine on Saturday. The consignment is the first shipment of a $200 million package the US approved in December. Conversely, the shipment arrived hours after Russia's foreign minister and his US counterpart held what they called frank talks to try to reduce the chance of a wider conflict in Ukraine. Also, it is believed that Washington is using the Ukraine crisis as a pretext to further its policy of attempting to restrain Russia and China. Washington has threatened several German companies involved in the construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline with economic sanctions. The completed multi-billion dollar pipeline is set to double Russian gas supplies to Germany, but has been entangled in a highly politicized approval process.
That pipeline, since more than 1 month, is ready to deliver. It's ready to deliver all that is missing, or nearly all that is missing, in the European and German market. But we are stopping it. We are blocking it on behalf of Washington. Crazy story.
Therefore, this is every indication that it is NATO members who are escalating tensions around Ukraine. The US, its NATO allies, and Ukraine have accused Moscow of amassing troops near Ukraine's border for a possible invasion. But Moscow says it has deployed troops along its western border to ensure its security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. The UK has accused Russia of trying to install an ally in Ukraine. This provoked a strong response from Moscow, calling the allegations nothing but nonsense and disinformation. In a statement released on Saturday, the British Foreign Office claimed to have information that indicates the Russian government is looking to install a pro-Russian leader in Kiev and is considering a former Ukrainian lawmaker as a potential candidate. It also claimed that Russia is gearing up to invade and occupy Ukraine.
They are doing regime change globally, and they think this is their God-given right to do that. They want it for Iran, they want it for South American countries like Venezuela, they tried with Guaido. This is typical Western policy, and now they're accusing again, you know, another country of what they are doing themselves. That is also a very typical US and NATO story.
It seems that London is following in Washington's footsteps. It has also threatened Russia with severe economic sanctions if it goes ahead with the alleged scheme. The UK had also supplied 2,000 missiles and a team of elite troops to Ukraine this week amid rising tensions. The timing and mysterious nature of the intelligence disclosure coincides with bombshell revelations about a series of parties at Downing Street during COVID lockdowns, as well as a record inflation level. It is also fueling the widespread discontent with the Boris Johnson government. He is now facing resignation calls even from within his own party. This raises a question, and that is whether some in the British government are simply eager to deflect attention from the problems that threaten to topple Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
What you heard was an IMRB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
all of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from Ladder's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. These events form our history and we must learn from them. But a nation that is alive does not look only at the past, it also looks at the next step to be taken and the horizons ahead in every stage of its history. In accordance with the developments of its time and in accordance with the duties that fall on that nation, we must identify the task to be done at the present moment. We must determine our steps for the future. And we must identify the horizon, fix our eyes on it, and move towards it with all our strength and power. In this way, the movement will be successful in the real sense of the word. In addition, it will achieve the final victory, which is first of all a pure life for the Iranian nation. If others learn from it, and if it becomes a model, this is another issue. But we should achieve prosperity and an Islamic lifestyle, which is a pure life that has worldly comforts, has both religion and welfare, and is good for both the body and the soul.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
At the present time, we are in the middle of the path. Of course, part of the way has been travelled up until today. The Iranian nation has worked hard and we have moved forward a little. But we should identify what our duty is today and what our duty and horizons are for the future as well. Sometimes one sees that they carry out polls. For example, they ask the opinion of the people. But these things do not show the truth of the Iranian nation. The truth of the Iranian nation is shown by the funeral of Martyr Soleimani. It is these things that show the mood of the Iranian nation and what their sentiments and feelings are. In other words, in order to understand the reality and feelings of this nation, a domain as great and vast as the country and people of Iran is needed. Therefore, the polls that some groups carry out here and there, some of which have ulterior motives behind them, and some of which are innocent, cannot be a criterion in this regard.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you.
In the limelight.
Richard Ogg, a silverhaired former electrician who switched to making his living catching crabs 2 decades ago, is a staunch supporter of the union representing fishing boat captains along America's western seaboard. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Chris McGreal. The piece is titled, American Fishers Want to Sue Big Oil for Killing Their Trade. But there's a catch. Richard Ogg, a silver-haired former electrician who switched to making his living catching crabs 2 decades ago, is a staunch supporter of the union representing fishing boat captains along America's western seaboard. But when he heard the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the PCFFA, was suing some of the world's largest oil companies for causing the climate crisis, Richard Ogg took stock of the barrels of diesel oil stacked on his vessel, the 54-foot Karen Jean, and wondered if the litigation was not only a mistake, but hypocritical. How do we run our engines without oil? How do we fish without oil? Electricity? I'm a small vessel, I'm only 68 tons, and my God, I don't know how that would work, said Ogg, who fishes out of Bodega Bay, about 70 miles north of San Francisco, California. The environmental harm brought by rising ocean temperatures has severely undercut fishing seasons and supplies, at a steep cost to the industry. And so, in response to years of setbacks, union leaders pursued a novel strategy to reclaim lost earnings, by going after one of the culprits responsible for driving global temperatures. 3 years ago, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the PCFFA, became the first private organization to join the growing number of lawsuits accusing the oil and gas industry of covering up research that warned about the dangers of burning fossil fuels. The plaintiffs want compensation for damage caused by global heating and to meet the cost of new infrastructure to cope with the climate crisis. They also demand the oil industry change its ways. Richard Ogg is not alone among West Coast fishing boat owners in questioning the association's lawsuit, and the head of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, Mike Conroy, knows it. When I first heard of this lawsuit, I had the very same thought. This is ridiculous, Conroy said. Mike Conroy said he understands the lawsuit looks hypocritical to many people because the fishing industry is so dependent on oil. But he said his views shifted when he looked more closely at the actions of the fossil fuel industry, particularly its cover-up of the warnings from its own scientists and its continued efforts to undermine measures to contain global heating. The skepticism among Conroy's members about suing Big Oil reflects sharp divisions in American society about responsibility for the deepening environmental emergency and the challenges litigants face in attempting to hold the industry to account. It's controversial, I get it, Mike Conroy adds. But then I learned that these oil companies were doubling down on these things they knew were bad. And if we're putting forth effort to reduce our impacts on the climate, then we shouldn't be doing that alone. The Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, representing about 900 family-owned fishing boats on the Pacific Coast, sued after a surge in blooms of toxic algae shut down fishing for Dungeness crab. The crabs are Oregon's most valuable catch, pumping about $75 million a year into the state's economy. and account for about one quarter of California's revenues from fishing. In 2013, a huge pool of warm water that became known as the Blob appeared off the Pacific coast. 2 years later, the Blob had grown to more than 2,000 miles long, running from the Mexican border to Alaska. Water temperatures rose to 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit, 2.5 degrees Celsius above normal, causing an increase in the neurotoxin domoic acid that delayed the opening of the 2015 Dungeness crab season along the west coast of the United States by months. The shutdown cost more than $100 million in lost earnings and wages by some estimates. Two-thirds of boats were docked and others had to move to different fisheries. The total catch was only about half of a normal year. I know a number of folks that lost their boats, they lost their homes, they lost their families, said Mike Conroy. Commercial crabbers face shortened seasons again in the following years because toxicity levels remained high and marine heat waves shifted krill closer to the shore, drawing endangered humpback and blue whales into crabbing areas where they are in danger of becoming entangled in fishing lines. In its lawsuit, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations blamed the Blob on global heating caused by the burning of fossil fuels and is seeking compensation for a harmful algal bloom unprecedented in its extent and in its persistence. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration study last year concluded that climate change is likely to result in a sharp rise in marine heat waves and a perpetuation of toxic blooms that might otherwise have washed away, with domoic acid hotspots becoming more frequent and more intense. The Dungeness crab season was again delayed last year on parts of the West Coast after new domoic acid hotspots were identified off the coast of Oregon, including near the port of Newport. Clint Funderburg, a member of the Oregon Coast Crab Association who fishes out of Newport, said he was reluctant to pin responsibility for the domoic acid outbreak solely on the climate crisis and therefore the fossil fuel industry. "They were some hard years, but these problems come and go. I'm not saying there isn't climate change, but there's a history of domoic acid on this coast, and I don't know if we can say it's one thing or the other causing it," he said. Richard Ogg does domoic acid testing for the state along a 30-mile stretch of coast in his area. He said the readings are consistently up, but like other fishing, his Pacific coast, he notices that it coincides with an intensification of the vineyard industry. "Climate change definitely is real. We know that, and it is impacting us. But it's really, at times, a cyclical thing. What we're looking at is a combination of a lot of things that are breaking down the system. It's not one thing in particular," he said. Toxic algae blooms have made regular appearances along America's west coast. An outbreak is believed responsible for the Great Bird Frenzy around beachside communities in Santa Cruz, California in 1961, which played a part in shaping Alfred Hitchcock's classic film, The Birds. But the intensity of the recent outbreaks and the scale of the Blob has scientists worried. Studies also show that the ocean is absorbing more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, making it more acidic. Among other things, higher acid levels affects the ability of crustaceans to build their shells. In the early 2000s, the increased acidity killed off large numbers of young oysters and mussels unable to form shells. Last year, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, released a study that showed that baby Dungeness crabs were being exposed to the same corrosive waters. Still, there remains the question of culpability. We all use diesel on our boats, said Clint Funderburg. I'm not going to point the finger just at the oil companies. They sell it, we buy it. The oil and gas industry has spent years deflecting from its central part in global heating, pushing the claim that it is doing no more than selling a legal product and that it is the individual user who bears responsibility for putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Four of the companies sued by the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, that is Chevron, Exxon, BP and Shell, are responsible for more than 10% of the world's carbon emissions since 1965. 19 of the 20 largest carbon emitters over the same period were oil and gas producers. But the major polluters have had some success in following the tactic of the tobacco industry and gun makers in seeking to disperse responsibility by putting the onus on individual user rather than the manufacturers. A Guardian opinion poll published in October showed that strategy has paid off, with 31% of the American public saying that individuals are completely or mostly responsible for the climate crisis. For his part, Richard Ogg is fatalistic. The problem for me is suing. It never seems to solve the problem. The oil companies aren't going to be hurt by a lawsuit. In fact, they want to continue, and they're going to continue, he said. Mike Conroy sees it differently. He says the lawsuit is intended to punish bad behavior and pressure the oil industry into changing its ways. A lot of my members don't have the time to sit back and actually give this a lot of thought, which is unfortunate. But after the last crab season in California, I think more and more of the fishermen are starting to ask questions that need to be asked, he said.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pereza, London.
Rashad Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After the Friday prayers, people gathered to protest against Saudi Arabia's ongoing war on Yemen, demanding Prime Minister Imran Khan to use his influence to stop the Saudi war on Yemen.
Yemenis chants are down with USA, down with Israel, and down with Al Saud. They are the best Muslims who are fighting with Israel and other US allies, sacrificing their children and loved ones. Those killing Yemenis are arranging anti-Islamic concerts in the Holy Land in the name of modernity, and even banned recently an Islamic preaching groups from India and Pakistan.
Yemen is facing an unequal war for more than 7 years now. The war has claimed tens of thousands of lives, many of them women and children.
Recently, we are witness that the Yemeni people are more than Palestinian and Kashmiris are oppressed. So it is our duty as a Pakistani, I feel that it's our obligatory duty to stand with the oppressed people of Yemen and to condemn all of the oppressors, including United States, European governments and their puppets, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and other allies.
Rights groups say while countries continue to turn a blind eye, there will be no end in sight to this horrendous conflict that has seen immeasurable suffering inflicted upon the men, women and children of Yemen. Yemenis have been knocking on all